This week on Decentralize, hackathons, careers in tech, economic arguments. Then we talk to Randall Schwartz, host of the podcast Floss Weekly.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm Jazz Ferguson.
I'm James Walpole.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralize.
So I went to my first hackathon this weekend, and it's probably one of those interesting things I've done since moving to Atlanta, and since kind of joining this sort of interesting technology space. It's not something I'd really heard of prior to beginning work in Bitcoin. Hackathon was a very weird thing, and I think it's kind of a newer type of competitive event, but I absolutely loved it. I wasn't participating myself. It was the Hackstart ATL, which was the first high school hackathon being held here in Atlanta. And we were actually hosting it at the BitPay office, so I was hanging out with a few of my coworkers, and we were sort of quote-unquote chaperoning the event, even though a lot of these students and participants were only about a year or so younger than me. It was really interesting, though. I mean, a lot of the people who came there really were not experienced in coding. They pretty much were just spending 24 hours fueled by Red Bull and making stuff, and I thought it was one of the coolest types of events I'd seen. What are your thoughts on hackathons, Sonny? Have you encountered them before?
I think before I make any statements on my thoughts, I probably have a plethora of questions, because no, I have not been to them before. I am very familiar with, you know, what I've read and people that have told me their experiences there. It seems like a very cool idea, and it seems to have worked very well for a lot of companies and a lot of smaller projects as well. I guess the question I have for you is, I know you do a little bit, Dev, you're kind of learning from what I understood, but I know that, you know, you would not consider yourself a developer. What exactly would there be there to do for someone like myself, who's definitely not a developer? Let's pretend there's a hackathon tomorrow and I'm going. What exactly could I do to participate in whatever is happening at the event?
That's a really good question. I like the way you phrase that, because, and really the way the founders of the hackathon explained it to me, this is really for people who want to learn. And a lot of hackathons are not like professional ones, not the kind of hackathons that produce things like Open Bazaar. That project did come from an idea that was produced at a hackathon. But there are a lot of hackathons for younger people in high school, college, et cetera, where it's just as much about like team building and idea making and learning as about the actual process of, you know, making an app or building a program. That's a small part of it. So at this hackathon, there were a number of workshops on just like basic mobile app development or, you know, using Java, that sort of thing. I didn't stick around for too many of them. Again, I was actually working on a project of my own over the course of the hackathon, which is not related to the hackathon. But it seems to be a really cool environment for it, because, again, like, you're basically just locking yourself in a building and making stuff with people. And I really like the kind of ethos that represents and the kind of environment that creates for people who do want to learn how to make things. So to answer your question, I guess, a lot of it just takes some ingenuity with ideas. And if you're kind of a creative person, if you've been exposed to a lot of really cool projects, maybe, if you have a knack for finding solutions to problems people have, that can be really helpful. There was no theme to this hackathon. Sometimes hackathons have themes like solve the water crisis in California or something like that. But this one just really was like create whatever you want. And there were some really cool projects that came out of it.
Sounds awesome. It'll actually a lot of fun. And I think that, you know, to digress slightly, but then it's actually completely about this, is something where, you know, everyone that knows me personally knows my reputation to be the cheapest person alive when it comes to managing marketing funds. I do not like spending money. I do think for tech companies, obviously, in particular, hackathons are a great way to spend money. If you want to use your and maximize your marketing dollars, hosting one, sponsoring one is a fantastic way to do it, because it does multiple things. One, it helps you get introduced to top talent. Two, it introduces you to maybe really cool ideas you wouldn't have had otherwise. Three, people that are in the developer community get not only know about you, but quite often have a positive opinion of what you're doing. And there's really very few downsides I see to this entire the explosion of popularity of hackathons. And I think it is something that's done way more in the past few years than it was before. It's great, and now that we're having this discussion, I now want to like Google it and find one and just go to it and kind of spy on it for an hour and kind of just see what people are doing and, you know, see what they're working on and what the conversations are, because I think this is something that can be applied to a lot of other fields and industries to a lot of success. You know, there you're in a situation where it's informal. You're there to do something, but you're also not required for to have a dress code or there's no really dumb, outdated requirements to participate. All you need to really have is ideas. They don't even have to be good. They just have to be ideas, and everyone else can tell you if they're good or not. And it's really cool. It's really a neat thing, and something that I'm remorseful that I've never really participated in or been a part of in the past, but extremely supportive when I turned my marketing mind off, or I should say on, and I think it's one of the best ways to use money. Way better than almost any sponsorship I could think of or advertising. Just overall, really, really a great idea and something that's blossomed into something really cool.
Yeah, I definitely agree. It's a really cool format, and it's a lot sort of like what you're already doing. If you're working in a startup or if you're working in tech, it's what you're already doing during the week time anyway. You're just getting paid for it. This is something where it's just sort of like you turn that into a form of play almost, and it has that competitive aspect to it, but it's a lot more substantive, I think, than a lot of competitions, because unlike maybe in a spelling bee or unlike in a football game, at the end of this, you come out with an idea that could go on to be something so much more, which is why I think the hackathon idea is so interesting. And another thing I do find very interesting about it is sort of the participatory aspect of it. Like you said, as a company, it's a great way to get people to actually be interested in using your products and building with your products. And by instead of just like forcing it on people, making it available and like saying like, hey, you know, you can do some interesting things with this project that maybe we haven't anticipated yet. It's a really cool way, I think, for individuals, companies, whatever, to crowdsource ideas for how their technologies can be used. And I'm really excited to see where that kind of format goes in the future.
The one thing I love about them, and this is more personal, is I have a terrible schedule, right? I have my entire life. I'm a night owl, and whatever happens, unless I have a very rigid schedule for a long period of time, I'm going to revert back to my stay up all night, sleep all day, vampire-like schedule. And I've noticed that a lot of people in this field share schedules. And since I now work from home and I'm working with everyone on the West Coast, my schedule automatically has to be different, because a lot of times they're just not, you know, awake when I am in the morning in the traditional East Coast hours. So I do like the idea that it's slowly seeping into society that we no longer should be living farm hours when a lot of our jobs are completely on a different timetable as well. And sometimes if we're working for things that are global, completely different timetables. So a very minor aspect to them, but something that I really appreciate, because I noticed that a lot of them happen to go all night. And, I do my best work at probably 3 a.m. And I'm my sharpest at 3 a.m. I'm not saying it's good. It's actually caused me a lot of issues in my professional life in the past, as there are many days where I went on one or no hours of sleep, and that's not fun. But just a minor aspect to it that I had to show praise for, because something that jumped out to me, you know, and maybe it wouldn't jump out to everyone else, but very cool.
I think your diagnosis is totally correct. That is sort of indicative of a change. Though the hackathon is just sort of like a small part of that, the fact now that like the innovation has become kind of embodied in a sort of playful sport almost like this. The fact that a lot of hackathons are, you know, you can live stream them, you can participate in them remotely. It might be like I would love to see the possibility of actually like companies starting that way, of a hackathon for startups themselves. You'd probably get a lot of terrible ideas from that, but it's just sort of further proof, I guess, to show that things are changing with how that works and everything. And again, while I didn't participate in this, I was up for just about 24 hours. It was really, really tiring. I got a few hours of sleep. We just sort of partied along and stopped by every now and then, have conversations and stuff. And while none of the people were working on Bitcoin related projects, it was still cool to see such young people working on these things. And I actually the theme of this Hackstart thing is actually jumpstart your startup career, which I found really interesting too. These were high school students. The founders of this and organizers of this event were like, I think the oldest was 18. The youngest is 16. He's a sophomore in high school. And they just did an absolutely brilliant job. So I want to give a shout out to those guys, and definitely check out their website, hackstart.me. We'll put some links in the show. So I think they're planning to really go much bigger with this. One of the reasons I was there, in addition to chaperoning, was actually giving a talk on behalf of Praxis, actually, on sort of how young people can go, if they want to, from high school to working in a startup or a dynamic company with or without a degree. And it was that was sort of my hackathon project. And something I find interesting too, because I think something like this event's so perfect for that. It's so indicative of the change, which I think is also happening in how people are hired and the possibilities for basically anyone who wants to get a job, especially in a dynamic field like technology, like Bitcoin, like other decentralized technologies, because it's less about where you're coming from, how old you are, what your status is, I guess, than about what you can make. Hackathon's all about the product you produce. It's all about the value you create, how valuable your idea is to other people. And I think that's quite an interesting corollary. I mean, as coming my experience in sort of doing this very early on as well, I think it's not an isolated one. And I think the hackathon mindset, I think the rise of a lot of alternative education programs, that sort of thing, a lot of opportunities in, especially in sort of the Bitcoin world for really young people, is really encouraging.
Absolutely. And this is something that I think we could probably talk on for a long time, but it brings me back to an article that you shared with me about this woman who created a really crazy, awesome resume, according to what I heard. I heard awesome from the quote, and that's a quote from the article, to get a job at Airbnb. And how well it worked. And, you know, it was something where the topic of youth in general, I'd say anywhere from, honestly, ages 16 to probably 25. I'm just outside that at 30, but close enough where I can at least relate. It's hard out there. It's very hard for young people. And one of my previous positions was helping young people get jobs, right? And it was very much at a community college, so not exactly the level that someone from Silicon Valley might want, but which is a shame because there were a lot of students that would come in that were brilliant and would have done a great job there. But it's difficult, and what else is happening is it's something where I think tech is probably one of the only well-paying fields that actually are aggressively hiring younger people. And that's sad, but it also has led to some ageism, but that's a different topic because I think in general, if you're a tech company, that older workers are very undervalued. You probably get great talent much easier if you're willing to go that way. But I will say this, and this is a personal anecdotal experience, is for years I did try to get in the tech industry, probably from when I was 18 or 19 to my mid-20s. Mind you, they were Michigan-based companies where, you know, I was at home and not, you know, anything in Silicon Valley or anywhere else. And I went on interviews, and obviously nothing ever came of it. I mean, for some reasons that I can identify that were my own shortcomings, and some that were not my shortcomings, that were the shortcomings of the hiring practices, you know. Everything from the what I always like to call the black hole of resumes. You know, when you submit your resume via one of those websites, and you know in person never seen it, but they're scanning for keywords. What a terrible way to hire someone. Seriously, just a miserable way. And one of the ways that people rely on technology, and it actually has made, is really does a terrible job at what its point is. To me, the best hiring practice is a good conversation. And just a terrible way to hire, and a lot of these larger corporations do it, and then they kind of often have the temerity to say things like there's a skills gap. It's like, no, the difference, though, is 50 years ago you were willing to train. Now you're not. You're expecting skills that aren't really taught quite often, or you just have unrealistic expectations. And tech is the one field where a good example is yourself, James, right? I am so happy for you because you came right out. That's your first, I don't know if you've ever had a job, but really your first job was BitPay. And it was working with us in the tech field. And I don't know, if you were kind of thrown in the deep end, for better or for worse, and I don't know if we freaked you out or if you loved it, but it seems like you loved it. You fit in well. You you achieved and you did fantastically, just fantastic in everything you've done. You know, it was an honor to work with you because you're so hardworking and just overall great experience. And it's something that will really shape you really for the rest of your life. And you're going to, you know, look back on these experiences and say, hey, I was really lucky. I was fortunate. I don't know if luck is the right word because you have hard work and intelligence and you put the effort in, but you're fortunate. You know, not everyone really has that chance, and myself included. I'm so fortunate to be in this position as well. But it's something where it's unique because if this was the auto industry or if this was any kind of manufacturing, believe me, they're not going to throw a position with as much decision-making power as you have at BitPay to someone your age at all. Much less, you know, is that something that happens quite often. So, and to be fair, you rose to the occasion, right? Like, it clearly was in their best interest to do what they did in hiring you, and it worked out. And I think that's something a lot of people just don't give people chances, right? And it really is something that needs to increase. And even though I'm getting texts from you to say, stop, because I'm saying good things about you, James, anyone who works with you will echo exactly what I said. So just take the compliment. But what I will say, though, is to anyone out there, I'm sure there's people that are 18 that are listening to this that really want to get into either Bitcoin or tech or maybe something completely unrelated, you know? And I'm terrible at offering unsolicited advice, so I don't necessarily want to say this is advice. But what I will say is, if you have a passion for it, you're going to work harder. You're going to have better ideas because you care. And that is the most important thing, is that you care. If you don't care, it's a job. If you care, it's pretty fun, and you really don't ever think of it as work. The only time I ever thought anything in Bitcoin as work is when I had to get up early, as we mentioned earlier. Nothing was worse. Even as much as I love this space, at 8 a.m., it's hard to love anything, and or even 7 or 6 a.m. So that is the major thing. And you know, I would love to hear a little bit about your experiences, you know, being since really tech jobs skew younger, quite younger, it's a unique situation. So what are your experiences with this? And tell me a little bit about what you thought about that article you shared with me, too.
Yeah, so I guess the reason I'll address the first part of your question first. So the reason I shared the article was I do think it's indicative of the extraordinary lengths to which you still have to go, I think, to show that you can create value in a crowded market. Because I do admit, and I think I recognize that it's still very, very hard to get a job, especially as a young person in an industry. I mean, it definitely seems to be easier in tech. What this person did, a young woman named Nina, who lives in San Francisco, actually moved there to work for Airbnb because she loves the company so much. She didn't create a resume. She created a website basically documenting her ideas for bringing value to Airbnb, for expanding that, for growing their company in the Middle Eastern market. And just absolutely like intricate design, attention to detail, all for this one purpose of getting an interview with Airbnb. And in fact, this Business Insider article said she has a call scheduled this week with, I think, one of the co-founders, which is somewhat maybe premature. Maybe they should wait till see how it goes. But the effort she went to put into looking for this job and creating value before she even had the chance to be paid for it, like working that hard for something, that's really impressive. And I guess if there's any reason I brought this up, it's not, again, not to talk too much about my experience, though I appreciate your kind words. I really do. And I appreciate your co-workership in those early months. It's about maybe what it takes now. It takes more than just sort of doing what you're told and doing and work, and even just working hard. It takes more than working hard. It takes more than wanting to work at a place a lot. It takes real key creativity like this, which is why I was so impressed with the hackathon students. I mean, just the fact that they were spending a summer weekend for 24 hours building stuff and focus intently on becoming the kind of people startups would want to hire. I find that really impressive. And I find that hopeful, even for people I would say I was very lucky in a lot of respects. I have been very lucky. But even for maybe people who don't, you know, have too many opportunities with that, it can be such a helpful thing to think outside of the box and how to show employers your ability to create value. So as far as my experience and what I found valuable, I think it's been just that a lot of times you really can't wait for things to happen to you in life or basically in this career process. So I say it's some proactivity, I guess, and I would say it's been helpful for me prior to even joining the space. I've just studied and learned a lot on my own and been really interested in kind of sharing ideas around technology myself, but also just throwing myself into it, being thrown into uncomfortable situations and kind of like the first, you know, parts of working in a company full time. Cause I've had jobs before this one, obviously worked in a hardware store, worked on a farm, that sort of thing. But, being willing to, be really uncomfortable, being willing to take ownership of things, take ownership of failure, and also just really focusing on ways you can provide value. Even if you're interning as an intern, which I did, interning as an intern or some kind of apprentice of some sort, or even working for free, which is what this woman is essentially doing, and which is, you know, definitely not a bad strategy to show people that you're serious about your work. But I would say just finding ways about making it about other people, making it about the value you can create, the value you can provide. And through that process, making a life for yourself and you know, really just not waiting on permission, which I think is a valuable concept to apply, whether it's with the college degree or whether it's with even just sort of the traditional hiring process. Because in a sense, even though this woman, Nina, has to wait on, you know, a call from Airbnb or has to, you know, set up an interview and ultimately be admitted, she didn't wait for permission to go out and do something which may ultimately be a part of Airbnb's strategy or may ultimately be something that provides value to Airbnb. She just went out and did it. And it's so possible for young people to do that today, which I think is really inspiring, and I think hackathons represent that. So that's really why I was so excited by what happened last weekend.
You know, and it's, I agree with almost everything you said, and I could go on about all that, but I actually would rather focus on the one thing I disagreed with, because that usually leads to a better conversation, and that is, you made the statement about how sometimes working for free is a good strategy. I disagree with that. I am and morally, and I actually don't think it's a good strategy at all. And I can't wait to hear your rebuff of what I'm about to say, so please do, because usually you have great responses that usually make me rethink at the very least. So I've always been very against the idea of unpaid internships. I think it is a terrible, terrible thing for both the business and the person that is the intern. The reasoning is that no matter what you do, as long as you're doing something for a company, for a startup, whatever it is, you're working, you're providing some value to what they're doing, and you should be compensated for that. Now, I'm not saying an intern needs to make a ton of money, but at the very least, they should be offered a minimum wage, and it should be something where there's also a financial incentive to show, hey, you know, we appreciate what you do. And while we were talking about generational things, this is a very generational thing itself, and this is where I will get very soapboxy, but I'll say this. I love how older generations love to defend unpaid internships when that was something that didn't exist in the form it does now back probably more than 20 or 30 years ago. You know, if you had an internship, you were most likely paid or it was an entry-level position. Now these exist quite often, and, you know, as someone, I think you as well, in marketing, there are so many unpaid marketing internships. And when I was in college, I refused to take that flat out. I was offered some, and I said, no, I don't work for free. I'm sorry. I don't care if you consider it an educational experience. I consider it work. And I value everything I do for a job. I don't care if I was digging ditches or doing something very complicated. I'm working, and I deserve something. Just very much something I deeply believe in. And when I did work at that college, that we were a part of unpaid internships that were offered through there. And it was unique for me because students, it didn't happen a lot, but it happened a couple times, would ask me. And I would always say, I don't know about you, but I won't work for free. And it's something I truly, deeply believe. And whenever I hear older people defend this practice, and quite often they're in human resources or they're in the career counseling industry or something, and they go on about how valuable of an educational experience it is, I just want to say, really? If you're 60, when you were 20 years old, would you have taken this? And if they say yes, I really challenge that, and I think that's usually dishonest. And I also think, what if they're doing something that's actually teaching you something, fine, but quite often these internships are getting coffee. They're entry-level things that really are just, I hate to say this, for lack of a better term, sorry for crassness, but bitch work. And, yeah, it needs to get done, but, you know, you should be paid for it. And I hate the fact that it's accepted as, oh, you need an unpaid internship to get a job. I see this echoed on Reddit a ton. And I just want to look at them and go, if you keep that attitude up, this isn't going to go away, right? Most of these employers can't afford to pay you. They just don't because they don't have to, right? So what you need to do is you need to have some spine and you need to say, okay, I'm working. I refuse to accept this. Yes, it may be harder for you in some ways, But if it's something you believe in, like me, and if you don't, then do what you want. I can't make your decisions for you. But I believed in it, and I don't know if it's improved my life or made it worse. But what it did do is it made me value what I bring to anyone I'm working for. And I know that, you know, maybe I don't have the most essential role in whatever I'm doing, but I'm doing something. And that means I should be properly compensated. It's a tough issue. It's one that whenever I would speak my mind and I worked at the college, I always got very negative responses to, and they were always from people that were probably 40 or 50 or older. And I always responded with, really? Because I don't believe, according to everything I've heard from people of that generation, unpaid internships weren't really a thing then like it is today. They existed, but it wasn't something that was approved or encouraged by colleges, right? It was something that really just existed kind of in the corner. Internships then were paid. And the fact that we've went away from that is a shame. And I'm very vocal about this, too. And I read an article recently by someone who was defending her unpaid internship with some political, I think it was the Bush campaign, and about how Hillary doesn't pay her interns either. And I was like, well, it sounds to me like you have sour grapes over working for free for a political campaign. And if you call it volunteering, fine, but don't pretend like, you know, what you provided for them, they valued it because they clearly didn't, or they would have paid you, you know? And it's something I'm actually quite passionate about.
Your passion clearly comes through, Tony, and definitely a lot of ideas wrapped up in there, but I guess I'll try to share my thoughts on the matter if anyone wants them. It's hard to say. So I think ultimately it does come down to a preference thing. I think any time you wander into the realm of sort of legislating what prices should be, you hit some problems. So first, I think, and maybe in favor of what you're saying, you could make the argument that when businesses sort of are paying for the work, and when people, young people, are maybe working for pay, they have more skin in the game, I guess. When you have to pay for an intern, you're going to be more selective in hiring the intern, obviously. Maybe you make better choices in who you bring on and the amount you invest in them in terms of training, et cetera.
And you also get better employees. You get, because they're being compensated. You get what you pay for. Just wanted to throw that in.
Exactly my point. Yeah, but I think there's some arguments against that point, which may be also worthwhile considering. First and foremost, I think one of the things you said is that a lot of internships are getting coffee and making copies and stuff, which is unfortunate and definitely not a very good learning experience. But it's also not creating too much value. So I really don't think there that that justifies, you know, earning wages necessarily. But again, there's no point in arguing over. It's really the preference of the employer and the person contracting with them for the work. But I think that's something to consider too. Is looking at. I mean, ultimately, if you're making a trade for wages or experience or whatever, you're trading value for value. So if you are a net positive value on someone, it shouldn't be too hard to make the argument for getting paid. But sometimes, and I can attest this from my own personal experience, sometimes interns cost more than they're worth, and just in terms of time, in terms of training, et cetera. And it's no knock on interns or young people. It's just sort of the nature of how people learn. So that's something to keep in mind. I think sort of the final and main thing is, and this is very analogous to the minimum wage debate, which has been going on for decades, which is you ultimately do limit the supply. When you create a price control, which in this case is saying like interns should be paid something, maybe what is it, $10 an hour, et cetera. But at that point, you're cutting a lot of people off from the opportunity to work for a company. So you basically, one of the things you said was, I won't work for that price, et cetera, which is a totally rational and valid choice, especially if you value that as a principal and and if you need a salary. But I would say if you really want to work for a company, and that's your main value is working for the company, being around big ideas and doing things. Maybe that's not what you want. Maybe you do want to work on that more than you want $10 an hour. So it's all a question of subjective value ultimately on the individual level. But I would suggest, it's helpful to don't create basically minimum wage. What it does, in an economy, all the other things being equal, is it does limit the supply of jobs available by making those jobs more expensive for employers to provide. So don't do the same thing for yourself individually by creating a price control yourself and saying, I won't work anything lower than this. Just think about what you may miss if you do that. But all things being said, I think you have very good points for why a company might prefer to do that, might prefer to do paid internships. I mean, that's been my experience. It's been a helpful thing for sure. But I think, you know, it's all about what you as an individual want, what you're willing to do, what you're passionate about having in terms of opportunities. And just taking that first step, at least, of being able to do some work for free and producing something to show that you're ready to create value, like Nina did with this Airbnb site, it's super valuable. It's something that not a lot of people are willing to do, and it sets you apart, I think.
Damn you and your always good responses that are logical. Yeah, a lot of what you said is right. When it comes down to being about the individual and really what they're seeking and what they hope to get out of it, and, you know, the site she did, to me, that's almost a way of marketing yourself. And it's weird when we come to, when I started thinking about it, when you were talking, one of the points you brought up is really there are a lot of things that are very similar to unpaid internships but aren't called that. Now, I think in general, if the term was changed that was used to volunteer, I wouldn't mind as much. But it isn't, so that bothers me. But when it does come...
I hate the term intern, by the way. I think it's terrible. I hate the word, actually. I would rather get rid of it. It calls to mind, like, it really calls to mind, like, internment, and putting people in prison. And honestly, interns as such are not, you know, I don't get the feeling that they're respected very much.
No.
Nope. I don't know if that's, like, a stereotype that's earned or not, but I would love a return to apprenticeships. But go on, Tony.
Oh, yeah. We can talk about that, too, because that's probably something that's very interesting. And what you're saying is right, and it reminded me of some factoid I saw, and I'm paraphrasing here, about how most young people think that large companies don't care about their employees. They only care about profit. And I wanted to talk to the young people that responded to this and say, yeah. And then I wanted to also follow that up with, and that's part of why we're in what we're in, and it's part of why so many businesses do such a shitty job, even though they can consistently grow. It's part of why people have very negative opinions towards certain companies, certain brands, and you know, it's something where you need to take into effect. And I think that any good business does this, takes into effect people. And you know, one of the coolest things when I worked with you at BitPay, that the CEO made it a point to say, was that we're people, we're not resources. People, you know, we're people that think we're people. That's all I can really go on there. And it's something that stands out to me and makes me say they need to value them more. And this is something that I think a lot of larger corporations don't have a priority or don't have as a priority, is taking care of their people, because they're the most important part of your organization. And I don't just mean the high level. I don't mean the middle. I mean all of them. They're people, and they're so important and essential. And quite often, the companies that treat their employees well, and I'm not saying, like, I'm not talking about the Silicon Valley well, like the, you know, we have a ping pong room or whatever. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about that maybe offer benefits to every level of employee that, you know, just, I think a good example is Costco, and really just what they bring and how they treat every single person that works for their organization helps. When I hear about Costco, I have a very positive connotation. I don't think of negative things. However, when I think about Walmart, I have a very bad thought, because every time I go there, it's unpleasant. The people that work there don't want to be there. Not only do they not want to be there, they make it very known they don't want to be there. And who cares if they lose their job, because what are they losing, right? Really, they're not losing much. And there is something to be said for that. Now, this has nothing to do with minimum wage. That's a completely separate issue. Mine is about appreciating people that work for you that are the nuts and bolts of what your organization does. And I wish I could think of the name, but there's a famous supermarket somewhere here down south that had a very loyal, very, very loyal employee base. And I believe they weren't even unionized. They were just very loyal employees who had a very understanding and a very people-first CEO who was greatly respected. And he would go to funerals of family members of some of the baggers at one of his stores and just had a very good relationship with his people. And he was being forced out as being a CEO. And as soon as I'm done, I'll look this up so the audience can know what the name of it is and look it up more. But he was being forced out, I believe, by his brother or something similar. And basically, the employees more or less said, no, we are all gone if you're forcing him out. Because the other guy wanted to make massive cuts and do what's typical in business, which is this misplacement of priorities, right? The idea that profit comes first has been so ingrained and pushed that it's so important that attention isn't paid to other very important things, like how happy your people are. Now, I'm not saying you need to forego profit, but what I am saying is if you take care of your people, customer service will be better, people have a better experience, and it shows in maybe intangible ways that will just really add value to everything you do. And I really, really, really think that's so important, so underappreciated by not just the CEO levels, but really every level. And if I could yell one thing from the rooftops, it would be that. And it's just something that I care actually very deeply about because I see it happening and I see so many people that go to work and just look like their souls were like sucked out of them. And that's just awful, you know?
It's unfortunate, but I think it's changing. And that's sort of why I'm hopeful about all of this. I mean, with not only, I guess, unemployed individuals being more empowered to find ways of getting the jobs they want just by sort of taking initiative using technology, being entrepreneurial, but also employees kind of having a little more entrepreneurial ability. It's definitely encouraging. And I think going back to what you said, I mean, we talked about economics on the show before, maybe we'll have to do a show devoted to profit, but I don't think it's a false dichotomy between, you know, being good to your people and being profitable as a business. I think it's a very, making profit is a key part of that. It's ultimately just creating value over, you know, value expended. So I disagree, I guess, that this is necessarily antagonistic to creating a good workplace environment. And I definitely disagree sort of on the, maybe on the notion of profit, but it means a lot of things to a lot of different people. And I definitely understand
where
you're coming from there.
Go into a little bit more detail about that. Oh, and also just for clarity, it's Market Basket is the name of the organization I was discussing before. I suggest everyone Google them. It's a great story.
Sure. So I'll explain a little more. I mean, ultimate goal of the company is ultimately to create wealth for people. So whether that means creating value for your customers.
I disagree with that, but continue. I'll go on about that in a minute, but I wanted to go back to that point, but continue.
Okay, so we're talking about the creation of wealth here, the creation of value. That can occur on a lot of different levels. When you're making profits, it basically means you're providing that value in an efficient manner over the costs and the inputs you put into your business. So I don't think we'd be entirely disagreed on that point. I think basically we're looking at sort of a different, maybe a different definition of profit, because one way of looking at profit is looking very narrowly at just sort of the short-term value created maybe for shareholders and maybe inflated valuations of your company. But ultimately that creation of profit, that not only the motivating force of profit of wanting to make a profit for yourself, whether you're an employee wanting to make, you know, more than you made last year, or whether you're a company owner wanting to basically gain on your equity, that's a motive. That motive of gaining more value than we had before is something we're all motivated by. And I don't think it's bad when you scale it up to the level of a company. In fact, I think it's quite a powerful force for doing good and for creating that value for everyone, whether it's employees, consumers, or the owners and shareholders themselves. So again, all the things being equal, that's not a force which tends to create division and conflict. It's a force that actually promotes cooperation and, you know, good competition, but ultimately the creation of more value you've had than before, and the movement of resources and skills and labor and et cetera to its best use. Of course, there are a lot of things that come in the way of that. There's a lot of corruption. There's a lot of use of power to prevent other people from pursuing their personal profit in the way they see best peacefully. We see that a lot in the world today, of course. And that's one of the things where, you know, why Bitcoin's an interesting thing as a way of, you know, moving money supplies and moving maybe ultimately transactions themselves away from, corruptibility by that power. But I mean, again, I think the profit motive itself, it's a very basic economic question, a very basic economic fact ultimately of human actions, that we do act to better ourselves. And to impugn that motive as it's, you know, on its own terms as profit would be a mistake.
The term you used, and this is something that, you know, you're way smarter than I could ever hope to be, so you did not go to college where this was shoved down your throat. The term shareholder value was something that is brought up so much, and it really is brought up as the be-all, end-all when it comes to any kind of business. And I it's something that the light bulb for this aspect didn't kind of go off until a couple years ago for me, but I just had a massive viewpoint change. Instead of saying, okay, you know, profit, gaining wealth, building wealth, as you would say, that should not be the number one goal of a business, because it leads to a couple, there's a couple things it could lead to, I should say. What should be the goal of a business is to stay in business. What that does is that building or gaining wealth, gaining profit, what that often does, not always, there's always exceptions, is it leads to lack of long-term thinking and planning, right? You don't think about what's going to happen 5 years from now. You're thinking about what are my books going to look like for the next quarter? And that's dangerous, I think. It's obviously opinion. And when you say that the profit being the main goal is a fact, I think you're roughly right in perception, but I don't see why it shouldn't be to stay in business. To stay in business should be your number one goal, number one. And that could mean break even some years. That could mean make profit other years. But it should be to stay in business.
Again, I guess I would disagree on that. And again, this is a really long conversation, and what I'll let you have the last word on. But I think it's relevant to all of us looking tech. I think it's a definitely a debate which I see raging in decentralization circles, especially around Bitcoin. There's sort of a there's a lot of connotations attached to the notion of profit. There's a lot of connotations attached to the economy as we see it, and whether we're really seeing cronyism or free market operations, et cetera. I would definitely say the former more than the latter. I think I don't think the ultimate goal is to stay in business. And I would say this applies to everything. So your ultimate goal, if you enter a hackathon, for instance, we'll use a hackathon example. Your ultimate goal is not to keep hacking for all eternity and not produce something. Basic like axiom of human action is we act to make ourselves better off. There's really no purpose to spinning your wheels for all eternity and staying, in, quote unquote, staying in business. There's a reason your business exists. There's a reason you started your business. There's a reason your employees come to work for you. They do want to be better off at the end than they were at the beginning. And ultimately, just staying stagnant is ultimately a net loss because you're not incorporating everything else like your time. Time being one of the most important things we have.
Yes.
So I would definitely say, I think I understand where you're coming from for sure, and I think I see what you're talking about. But maybe understanding profit on a different level, understanding how it again how it works in the absence of a lot of other sort of corrupting forces like power itself, is a helpful thing. It's a helpful thing for gaining insight, I think, into human action, gaining insight into even such questions as we're talking about, which is, you know, how can young people look at how they're creating value in the workplace, how they can actually achieve what they want to achieve in the world without necessarily feeling victimized or feeling unable to do it or feeling like they have to wait for permission. And sure, there's a lot of injustice out there and a lot of things like that. But I would say, you know, having a good grasp of what your skills are, where you can create that profit for other people and for yourself, can be a very, very helpful thing and something I'm definitely hopeful for the future of the tech industry and hopefully for others. Hopefully we'll see the same kind of not only like decentralization of opportunity and the kind of same kind of low barriers to entry, but just general kind of openness to creativity in the automobile industry one day, in the food industry and the service industry, whatever you have.
Absolutely. And this is a fantastic conversation as always. And we could talk about this all night and someday we may, but we will not today. The thing I actually wanted to wrap up with is a little bit that I would encourage all of our listeners to check out is Coinbase listed their 5 most exciting Bitcoin related companies. And I wanted to encourage everyone to check them all out. And they're 21, Abra, Blockstream, Streamium, and this little project called Augur, that has a really dreamy marketing guy that's tall and dark and handsome. I think it just, as someone from Augur, we're honored to be on this list, and we're honored that anyone, regardless of what company they're with, would say that we're an exciting company. And I think that a couple of these especially are more exciting than others. I won't make that statement, but I will say that I'm an avid supporter of, obviously, Augur and Streamium. I think Streamium's a really cool platform. We had the guys on a few weeks ago, and what they're doing has potential that's huge. And just in case you haven't noticed, what they could do to the pay-per-view industry is gigantic. And investigate that, and then you'll kind of see why I'm so bullish on that. So rather than sending everyone home with a last point, I want to send them home with something to check out and cool companies to check out. So with that being said, James, any last words?
Well, I hope that both Augur and Streamium both make a hefty profit on this. And,
awesome. And I actually do too, because I'm a hypocrite. So.
I don't think you are, Tony. It's a pleasure to talk with you as always.
Today we're joined by author and podcast author Randall Schwartz, who's written several books on the Perl programming language and is a host of Floss Weekly. Thank you so much for joining us today, Randall.
Well, thanks for inviting me. This should be cool. I hope it's cool. It's actually very warm, but that's not the same as cool. But it'll be cool in content. Yeah, there we go.
Well, where are you right now?
I am in Portland, Oregon, actually a small suburb of it called Beaverton, Oregon. I've lived around this area all my life, and I don't plan on ever moving, even though I spend most of my time either on cruise ships or down in Southern California where my primary clients are. But, and I just got back from Porto Alegre, Brazil, I was presenting at a conference, spoke about the Dart programming language and about, what's the other thing? Oh, my 50 years, half my life with Perl, so 25 years. Perl turned a couple years ago, and I turned 50 same year, so I thought, hey, I'll do a talk about it. And I relabeled the talk My Half-Life with Perl, because I thought it was more fun.
So you've moved from Perl to Dart. Is that your new programming language of choice?
I've got a client that's willing to pay me to do it. And Dart reminds me a lot of Smalltalk. I was doing Smalltalk back in 1982. So, of course, when Perl finally got objects, that was really nice because then I could go ahead and do real object-oriented programming and stuff. And so, and Perl 6, of course, is all objects, so it's going to be even more fun to play with. But Dart is also objects from top down, and it has a lot of feeling of a modern language. They got Cascades right, which is nice. Cascades are always backwards in Smalltalk, where you had to say yourself a lot of times in the end of the chain. And the dot-dot operator in Dart is actually correct. They got it right the second time around.
You know, it's funny. I hear a lot of references to Smalltalk and Smalltalk 80, for example, as being a very technically correct language. And a lot of people sort of reference historically, and why didn't it take off? What in your mind actually prevents a technology that is superior from being adopted, and why do inferior solutions actually supplant them?
Wow, that's an interesting question. Let's see if I can give you any kind of answer for that. One of the problems with Smalltalk is that it was $1,000 or $10,000 a seat, and that was way too expensive. Nobody could afford it at that rate, and so there were a couple of like open source Smalltalks that came out, but they didn't have any traction, so it was it just sucked. I'm really hoping Dart now, because it's got Google behind it, and Google's actually using it for an internal project, so it really is going to be a very solid language to be programming in. And I'm sort of in at the ground floor. It's about the same point where I got really involved with Perl. It's about where Dart is right now. So that tells me a lot. If I can start writing courses and books and trainings, things like that, all around Dart, and that's why I started by doing this one-hour talk down in Porto Alegre, then I can get on the ground floor and build up a training company again. You know, Perl training is pretty much dead, so I need to find something else that I can use to make a reasonable income until I'm well into my retirement age.
So you have a very long history in this, Randall, and most of our listeners probably know you through Floss Weekly, but I kind of want to ask, so can you tell us a little more about your career background before the show, how you first encountered programming, and how you came to host a podcast from there?
Well, that's interesting. It's actually the content of the talk that I gave in there, so it's all really fresh in my mind. The biggest thing is that my dad had a really strong work ethic, and he said, son, you're going to have to go make yourself a living at some point here. And so I looked around, I realized I kind of liked math, and I kind of liked electronics, and I thought, well, computers are sort of the intersection of that. Now, this is computers back in 1976, where pretty much this was just before Pop Electronics had the Altair 8800 on the cover, but I built an IMSI 8080 for the high school that I was at. So I knew that I wanted to be a programmer. I just knew that I wanted to do that. And then through a bunch of accidental career choices, I actually ended up being a technical writer as well as a programmer. And then from there, I migrated to teaching. So I started doing all these different things. I was just kind of like a Renaissance guy, a little bit of everything in the community. So, I mean, there's a little piece of my code in every copy of Emacs Lisp. There's a little piece of my code in the Perl distribution, obviously. But I've been around so many different things that it's just been really a lot of fun. Never bored.
So what is it that you think actually makes good technical content? So like it's really difficult for a lot of for programming concepts to be conveyed easily and simply. What is it that makes it accessible to someone who might not be aware of a concept? And what makes things accessible to people who might not be aware of how programming works in general?
Well, the trouble with answering that question is I learned programming long before I had any kind of meta-analysis about how I learned something. So I don't really, like even learning Perl, I say right in front, this is not to teach you programming. This is to teach you how to program in Perl, but I presume you already know what a subroutine is and what subroutines and array. Those are the two things that I think if you've got those two concepts down, the rest of everything can fill in almost every language. So, but I was trying to remember how I learned about how to do an array, and I couldn't think back to that far because I was back when I was 9. That's a long time ago, so I have no idea how to teach that. And same thing with subroutine. I can kind of teach subroutines, but I think it's much better to already have an array figured out. Why would you need one? Why would you want an index? Why would you want indirect variables like that? That doesn't make any sense unless you actually finally get into it. Another thing that's very important, I think, in the tutorial books and the articles I've written, is that I'm very careful about what to leave out. I actually think of training and teaching and articles that I've written and want to end up at the other point at the other end. And so I try to take the smallest number of moves it takes to get from one end to the other. And I think too many people ruin a good tutorial by packing everything in like it's a reference. And I think that's probably why my books have been successful and really approachable.
And Randall, you were saying you kind of began programming, especially in Perl, about 25 years ago, kind of at the birth of the open source movement. But I'm curious, when you were young and kind of picking this up, would you say you kind of had open source instincts? Was there any kind of like proto-open source thing going on in the community or basically just with how you approached it?
Well, back in those days, we called it shareware. It wasn't anything like open source. Although, once I got to see the source code of Unix V6, and I went, well, this is really incredible that I can study every little aspect of this thing. And then I heard about the GNU movement and the Free Software Foundation, and that got me a lot more interested. And so, you know, having access to all these open source tools really helped my education process. And now it's sort of a given that everybody's going to do something in open source, and proprietary seems to be the exception rather than the rule these days, which is I'm really appreciative of, so it's very, very nice.
So it really helped you personally to learn because you could actually study the source code, but what do you think the impact that it is that open source has on society as a whole, though?
I think the fact that you don't have vendor lock-in in terms of people being able to help you out. So in other words, if I buy Microsoft products, then I have to go to Microsoft to get bugs fixed and to get more training and education, although there's some third-party stuff for that. But really, I'm locked into whatever the features are that it ships with. Whereas with open-source software, particularly in translations, there's not a lot of people that translate to Brazilian Portuguese. And so now by having open source, they can take all this code and translate it so that native users can use it in their language of their choice. You know, most technology people speak English, thank God, because that's otherwise my five-day conference would have been really boring. But no, I think that's really important. I think it's important to have, you know, not have vendor lock-in in terms of having software. Plus, you get to leverage your user base. So like on code that if I released it as proprietary code, then I have to hire all the programmers I need to make it better and better. Whereas with open source, other people can contribute back to me. And a lot of the projects we've had on Floss Weekly, we do have that sort of sharing going back and forth. I'm a little more concerned about the projects where the end users probably aren't also programmers. So they get a lot less contribution. But I've even talked about, well, if you can't contribute code, maybe you can contribute use cases or places where you'd like another feature. And that's great because the actual people building the software then can get more guidance about how it would be more useful for other people. So you don't have to code. There's probably a dozen different ways that you can contribute to open source without even picking up a line of programming.
No, it's amazing to see how widely the open source ethos can be applied, and we've seen that in a lot of projects we've had on the show that have been not just purely technical in nature. But my question for you, I guess, would be, what was the inciting moment when you kind of went from focusing mainly on technical writing to also starting Floss Weekly? And for those who have not listened to the show, can you explain what Floss is and how it's different from dentistry?
Okay, yeah, I didn't create the show. I took it over at episode 17. Originally, it was Chris DiBona and Leo Laporte, and I was brought on as a guest on episode 9, talking about Perl, obviously, and also other things in my history. But then it went through pod fade. Chris DiBona had a baby. Well, his wife had the baby. I think he's got involved, though, somehow. And there was, like, no more shows. And I was actually on Leo Laporte's TV show, who was doing it in Canada. And I said, what happened to Floss Weekly? And he said, well, why don't you bring me some guests? And I said, oh, okay, and then I can co-host? He goes, yeah. So I did that for about 2 or 3 years, and then turns out that Leo wanted to move on and do some other shows because he saw it was in good hands, so I became the full show runner. So I decide the topics. I solicit for people to be on the show, which I do every week. I beg for more guests because it always makes my work a little bit easier. But that was also a breakthrough. About 3 years into my show running, I started crowdsourcing who's on the show. And I have discovered so many amazing different projects because of this that I would never have gotten to. And I read tons of blogs. I read open source, you know, documentation and stuff. But I would never have gotten the variety of stuff that I've that my crowd has actually brought me. So I really appreciate that for them.
So is there any, like, projects that specifically maybe have you've found support because of your listeners? I mean, obviously your podcast itself has benefited from, you know, you crowdsourcing these things. But are there, you know, programming efforts or, you know, projects that have benefited from that?
Yes, we get a bunch of bumps, all except for the really big established projects. But like SaltStack said, we put them on the map, you know, which is really cool because they were just a fledgling little group and maybe had 20 developers or something, and all of a sudden, you know, my show, I don't know the exact numbers, but I'm guessing the downloads are somewhere between 20 and 50,000 a week, and that's counting all audio and video and everything like that, and that's a significant bump, especially for a small project. So, yeah, in fact, they often say things like, you know, we slashdotted, if you remember that old term, their website sometimes. It's like, oh, no, look, they're all coming to see it. Well, I think that's the kind of problem you want to have.
So for you, what have been the most interesting projects you featured on the show, the most compelling, and just the most fascinating?
Wow. Oh, boy, how did you do that in 430 episodes? Let's see. Well, Dart got me started being aware of Dart, and we're actually doing a follow-up to it in about three or four more weeks because there's been a lot of progress in the last couple of years. I wouldn't have known about Dart until somebody suggested that as one of my projects. There was a lot of cloudy cloud stuff for a while there. We were doing, the Red Hat community coordinator was actually bringing me projects. Of course, they're all like cloud related. So people kept saying, are you going to have another show about cloud? I mean, why do you keep doing this? I go, well, there's so many different things. There's Overt and all the, anyway, it's too hard to remember everything, but yeah, so it's luckily we kind of went through that phase and we don't have anything like that anymore. But, you know, and having BitPay on was pretty amazing, so that was kind of fun. I guess that would be relevant for this show. Boy, I just kind of remember. I think the heat is affecting my brain. Well, anyway, yeah, no, it's just been fascinating. And I always try to make sure that it's not a news show. It's a more of a magazine format, which means that I want there to be this huge back catalog of content that people can go back and pick up, you know, as an introduction to that. So I've rarely had the same project on twice because, things move a little bit, but they don't move that much necessarily. So I'm pretty hesitant when somebody says, now we're up to version 1.6, can we do it again? I said, no, there's plenty of other people ahead of line for you. So just go back and listen to the old show. And although they're not in the RSS feed, they are all the way back to episode 1 directly on the Twit website. So you can dial in any number you want all the way back to number 1. So a quick little curl command can actually download them all. So
that's fantastic. We distribute our show on BitTorrent, for example, and we're about to start publishing a sort of an anthology where you can just download everything as a single torrent because we encourage free distribution.
Nice.
Yeah, so what do you think is one of the biggest opportunities for open source? Like, what is the most important areas where open source needs to be applied today? And this could be outside of software if you think that that's appropriate.
Well, I'm really liking, I'm not part of it, but I'm really liking the open hardware movements, you know, the makers and things like that. I think there's a lot of stuff going on there. Aaron Newcomb, one of my co-hosts, is really into that. And I believe Guillermo is also big into the maker movement. And I don't have time to play with hardware because, for one thing, I'd have to carry it on every flight that I'm on. It's because I'm only in Portland maybe 3 days a month. So I can't have stuff here and I can't have stuff in hotels down there. So I'm pretty much limited to whatever I can carry on my laptop.
So Randall, I guess a broader question related to Eric's might be, do you think open source is kind of on the rise? I mean, we've obviously had the open source movement for about 25 years, but so much of kind of just the architecture of what we use now is based on some degree of open source software, whether it's kind of Android or maybe servers using Linux. Do you think we've kind of hit a point where it's become more common, or do you think it still has a ways to go to become really embraced by the public?
I don't think there's any question anymore about whether it's okay to open the source up for your codes. I mean, I think we've had enough successful projects demonstrate that open source brings more benefits than it would cost. Now, there might be some pointy hair bosses out there that still don't agree with that, but I think we're mainstream. Now, like I said, it's now unusual when somebody says, I'm going to release some proprietary software here, because they have to go, what? That means we have to hire all the people that are ever going to fix this, and we won't get user contributions and all that sort of stuff. And I think it's just silly when people say, let's choose a proprietary solution now. I am a bit biased, obviously, because I live in the ecosystem where open source is the main thing, but I'm still, I get yelled at for running an iOS phone and my Mac laptop, but at the end of the day, it gets my job done, and a lot of the software that's on my laptop is all open source. So I'm pretty happy with that as well. So I compile GNU Emacs every morning just to make sure it still works on a Mac. I compile Git every morning to make sure it still works on a Mac. So I'm kind of like the canary in the coal mine for those things. Again, another way you can contribute without actually writing any source code. All I do is wait until it breaks, and if it breaks, I just submit a bug report. I don't even fix the source code there. I don't care. I don't know that. My C skills are rusty again, so I'm not doing much that way. But I compile Perl 6 every morning just to make sure that it's moving forward too. So I have this little tmux script that goes and starts with like 8 windows of download and downloads all the source code and then starts compiling it. So it's really fun to bounce from one window to the other as different things get built.
That's really cool. Does your sort of open source philosophy in running as much open source software as you can, does that run all the way down to, say, the BIOS, or the, I guess it's replaced by something more secure UEFI now?
I'm actually not a card-carrying member of the Free Software Foundation. I think it's perfectly okay to run whatever you want to run, whatever gets your work done at the end of the day. I actually prefer the BSD-style licenses because I think they give more freedom to the people that are downstream. The thing about the GPL is that you actually, the original author has more rights than every other author after that. And I think that's unbalanced. But some people disagree. But that's me and them disagreeing. So, yeah, I prefer BSD-style licenses. That's me.
Well, let me get you to expand on licenses for a second. So, first of all, our audience may not be explicitly aware of, you know, GPL versus BSD. But we'll include some links to both licenses in our show description. What are your thoughts on an MIT license?
I consider the permissive licenses like MIT, Apache, BSD style, all the variants on that. I consider all those to be permissive licenses, and that's as opposed to, say, the GPL and the LGPL family and stuff. I consider those to be very restrictive licenses. And so, yeah, I don't have any problem with MIT license. Perl's artistic license is very similar to that, too. So I'm very happy with that. I think it allows for the ultimate freedom. It allows for you to get your code in more places than giving it under the GPL would. I really believe that.
So, Randall, what do you see as being some of the most common shared features you've seen in all the projects you've had on the show that have been most successful? So what really makes a good successful open source project? Obviously, we have kind of the foundational stuff like releasing the source code and involving the community, but of the most successful ones you've seen, what have been the most standout features?
The biggest thing, I think, is making sure that you embrace the community. Your bug tracker should be public. Your GitHub or whatever you're doing, your source code in, should be public. But Simon Phipps taught me this over and over again, is that your governance also has to be public. In other words, you can't have the company just open source its project and take no input about what the roadmap's going to look like. So there has to be a third party. There has to be a governance committee that's not just people in the company. And I think a lot of people don't get that right. But if they get it right, I think it has legs on its own. You know, it's like if you look at all the projects that Oracle ruined when they bought Sun. You know, everything had to ultimately fork. You know, we had Hudson became Jenkins. What are some of the other ones? MySQL became Maria. The only one they haven't ruined yet, I think it's because they don't know they have it, is VirtualBox. They renamed it Oracle VirtualBox, but they haven't ruined the project yet. I don't know how that one's actually made it through. So, don't tell anybody, okay? I don't think Oracle knows they own it.
Well, that's really interesting. So have you ever, you know, some of the guests that you've had on, have you ever gone off to contribute to those open source projects?
Not as often as I'd like. My schedule is really crazy busy with all my travels and all the, you know, I still have, you know, day job clients that I have to take care of, and I try to get anything I'm doing, though, to be open sourceable. So, yes, I have sort of contributed back to Perl from time to time with the CPAN stuff. I think I've helped out with Salt a little bit there, too. And I'm definitely being very active in the Dart community, so I'll probably end up writing some code. Their equivalent of the CPAN is called the Pub. They try to stay in this whole, Pub theme, you know, darts and pub and all the other things like that. So that's their theme, which I can't disagree with, so that's good.
Now, you've had a number of open source as well as decentralized technology projects on your show over the past few years, and obviously you've had Copay on the show, you've had one of our co-hosts, Tony Sakic's project, Augur, on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And my question for you, I guess, you've been in the open source software movement. We're sort of the decentralization movement, as the name implies. Mm-hmm. Do you see a connection between decentralization and technology and open sourcing?
Not immediately, except, of course, for it to be decentralized, it'd have to be open source. I mean, that would just be an absolute mandate, because how are you going to have a decentralized system when you have to get the binaries from somebody proprietary? That's weird.
And what are your thoughts kind of on the projects you've seen that have been decentralized? Do you think that's a promising direction for technology to take, or do you think it's kind of a more immediate and localized of Bitcoin?
Well, I was actually sort of amazed by the Augur show. I didn't really understand it, and it looked like it was going to be buzzword bingo worthy. You know, then all we'd hear hearing is keywords the entire time. But the interview actually went really well, and I finally understood what it was all about. And I'm sure there are some people that were my listeners that had that same sort of aha moment about how this is done. You know, how do we have polling where it makes sense for people to be able to put a question out there? And how do we have this decentralized verification that the results are actually accurate? Both of those problems are solved with this. It's pretty amazing. So, I like that. And I'm not much into Bitcoin. I still have 0.05 Bitcoins that I got for free many, many years ago. And I think it's like, what, $100 now or something? $30? Somewhere in there. Probably depending on what day it is. But I haven't done any more with that. So I'll probably start playing some more with it now that I've been on these projects.
Well, let me go ahead and ask you a little bit more about the Bitcoin question and tie it back to an earlier thing that you said about successful open source projects. The biggest point of discussion lately is in the governance of Bitcoin. There is no company behind Bitcoin. There's not even really a team that's responsible for it. It's open source software, and it's in fact encouraged that people modify it and go do things with it. What is your read on, you know, the model that Bitcoin has taken as opposed to, say, the model that, you know, Node.js or Dart, or even more specifically the Linux model, where, you know, Linus is sort of like the authority figure there. Mm-hmm. What's your read on that?
It's interesting. I can't imagine, though, how, you know, where are you going to get the roadmap, or does it really matter? I mean, could you ever fork the code and have it do different things, or are you always going to have to respect, you know, specification 1.0, which is the only specification right now? You always have to respect that if you're releasing, you know, blockchain-related materials. And I'm glad that the original developer had the sense of putting the code in there to do the sidechain stuff, because it would be impossible to add it now. You know, because we can't fork the specification at this point anymore. So it's unless there's some backward compatibility thing, but I don't even imagine how that would work. I haven't thought too much about it, but yeah, I don't know. Bitcoin seems pretty successful, so you know, it's not consumer successful yet, but that's okay, because a lot of open source software isn't consumer successful. People may be using Google every day, not realizing that's all Linux computers instead of Windows, because they wouldn't know the difference, and they don't care. As long as they get Google search results and up comes, you know, their cat pictures, they're fine.
So Randall, as you said, Floss has had over 400 episodes now. You're going strong.
Yeah.
I'm very curious, and as a podcaster who's been doing this only for about 30 episodes, we're at episode 39 right now. How do you maintain that steady schedule of producing? What does your schedule look like? How do you sort of get your guests and your co-hosts every week? How do you find a way to make that consistent production?
Well, I spend about 4 hours a week, I think, in terms of calculation. But that also includes the actual hour and a half of taping live. But no, behind the scenes, I have to manage the schedule. We have a Google spreadsheet where I when somebody wants to be on the show, I say, well, go add yourself. Go figure out what date you want. It's got a question mark in the first column. Pick that. And then I, about every 2 months, I roll forward another quarter of dates so that I can get that all. I'd have to tag out the times when I can't host. And so before I open those shows up, I need to make sure that I have at least one of my other rotating panel co-hosts can migrate to being the host for that show. So then I can open those up. So I'm about to do this for Q4, and I'm going to miss at least, I think, four shows in Q4. So, again, I can't open those shows until somebody else like Aaron Newcomb or Simon Fitz has come along and do that. So the spreadsheet, the public side of the spreadsheet, has just the project name and the hosts. I have a private side to that same spreadsheet, which I figured out how to do in Google Spreadsheet. It's really cool, where I have like the contact email, whether I've got the rundown brought back yet, you know, what the state of that is. And now I have a new column for sponsors. So that way, if somebody wants to opt out of being reading the code for a particular sponsor, they can let me know ahead of time, and so I'll make sure to mark them out. Oh, yeah, and one more column that has, like, no GA, yes DL, so Dan Lynch can do that show, but Guillermo Amaral can't. And so I just have to keep going forward and looking at it, and about every few days I get a tickler item on my to-do list that says, go move Philosophy Weekly forward a little bit. There's got to be something to do. Just ask for new guests or something. So, yeah, it's a lot of work, but it's also helped me be a lot more famous. I was worrying about what after Pearl. And it used to be I'd go to a conference like OSCON, and people go by, love your Pearl books, love your Pearl books, love your Pearl columns. But then that started fading out a little bit after about, I think, about the late 90s, early 2000s. And I said, what am I going to do next? What can I be an expert on again? And then I just happened to bump into Leo Laporte, took on this podcast. And now when I go to conference, even Pearl conferences, people come up to me and go, love your podcast, love your podcast. So I have made successfully transition from one way of being famous to another way of being even more famous. So I'm going to keep doing this show for as long as they let me.
So would you say that the reason that you've done this is certainly for personal interests, mm-hmm. But would you say that that podcasting and passion-driven projects can actually help you acquire more work? Is that something that you've found?
Yeah, I've figured out that if I'm famous, more people like me. And so more people like me, they're more likely to hire me. I know the last four companies, the last four long-term clients, when I've been there for longer than 6 months or a year, have all said, we all listen to your podcast. We really appreciate it. Well, yeah, and this is a Pearl shop, so we know you from there. But really, it's about the podcast, it's about me bringing that. And I often, you know, like when I'm taping at ZipRecruiter, I'll say I'm here at ZipRecruiter. You know, so that they get their name out there as sort of a low-level advertising too. But yeah, so it has been significant. It's definitely been significant for getting me gigs, and also all the privilege of getting to speak with all these big projects all around the world. You know, Linus Torvalds and I play pool together here in Portland. You know, I met him because I wanted him on the show, and so got there. Same thing with Monty. You know, getting Monty Wadini is talking about Maria and getting that all up to date. So I've gotten to talk to some of the big, as I say in every show, the movers, the shakers, the big projects, and the little projects, projects you might not have heard about. So I really make sure I want to cover all that whole broad base of anybody I can, and it's a privilege. And it's a lot more fun, and I'm getting a lot better at it, too. So over the years, my interviewing style has gotten very honed in.
So as you mentioned earlier in the show, you're in a very hot climb. So we're going to ask you one or two more questions and then let you go. So you can get in some cooler temperatures.
Yeah. But I may just go take a cold shower, too. We'll see. It's like it's getting really crazy here. Yeah. Go ahead.
I'm curious, but what are your thoughts on the future of podcasting as kind of a medium for communication? I mean, it's been out there for a few years now. Some people have done really well in it. There are kind of a lot of podcasts out there. But do you think we've hit peak podcasts, or do you think it still has a lot to offer?
I think as more and more people discover how to subscribe to podcasts and also how simple it is to produce them, I mean, there's a lot of work involved, but there's not a lot of technology involved. I mean, here we are using Google Hangouts. We didn't have that 3 years ago. And so now we can have this global conversation where we get videos automatically switched for us, we get audio merged together, and it's a game changer for that. Anybody can be doing podcasts. Anybody can be doing YouTube videos to talk about, doing their trainings and stuff. And now you've got, you know, YouTube subscribe channels, things like that. I think it's just going to keep getting more and more like that. And especially as we get more and more connectivity, where we're getting faster and faster stuff on our mobile apps, I think that's going to keep changing it too. So I don't think we're anywhere near peak podcasting. There's already too many out there for me to subscribe to. So I don't think I'm ever going to be bored. It's like, Randall, why don't you read audiobooks? I go, I don't need audiobooks. I have so much podcasting backlog that I can't even touch them.
All right, Randall, as we're wrapping up the show, why don't you go ahead and share some where the people can find you on the web, social media, URLs. Where can people get connected with Floss and some of your other projects?
Okay, well, the twit.tv/floss is the homepage for the podcast, and there you'll find links to my email address, merlin@stoneinge.com, in case you want to suggest possible projects or get them to suggest possible projects for me. I'm also Randall L. Schwartz on Google+. I am Merlin on Twitter. And let's see, where else am I? I'm all over the net, actually. There's a Wikipedia page about me that lists most of this, so just go there. That'll be fine. Or www.stonehenge.com/Merlin, with a Y, M-E-R-L-Y-N. That's my personal homepage, but it's woefully out of date. You know, the Shoemaker's Children problem. I don't have any time to keep my own website up to date, so... I just blog a lot, and it seems to work out pretty well.
All right. Well, Randall, again, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a fantastic conversation, and hopefully we'll see you again soon.
Yes, hopefully before I melt, we can get going here. Thanks.
Yep.
Decentralized was edited and produced by Chaz Ferguson. Music written and performed by Tony Leeds. You can download past episodes at decentralized.fm or on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/decentralized-podcast. And follow us on Twitter at @decentralizeall.